In Fortnite, I've chosen to speak about the next one of the four protective meditations. I've started last year to speak about the four protective meditations, and some of you might not have been here. So just slowly go over those one more time. And then I'm gonna speak about a practice which is called recollection of the Buddha. So it's a practice where we are, reflecting on the qualities of the Buddha as a means to uplift the mind and also reflect back to us that because the Buddha was a human being and we are human beings, we actually have that same capacity. So give us a sense of the potential which our mind has. And just, to speak a little bit about the four protective meditations in general, they are ways, to developing courage to meet whatever we have to meet on our path. And that those four protective meditations are the following. The first one is, we already did that last year, is called Asubha. This is called practicing with investigating the body, what it truly is when we are looking under the surface of it. And what we find is that the body is a very, not necessarily beautiful if you are cutting it open and open it up. What you find is maybe amazing and awesome, but it's not necessarily beautiful. And it's a very vulnerable, process of so many parts and pieces, working together in a way which is hard to fathom. So it shows us a different side of the body, and it helps us to be able to be less, fascinated with the outer appearance and balance that out with a different side we usually don't think much about. So that's our super practice, and it's considered an antidote to being too attached to one's body. And also it shows us, that the body is actually a riding animal for consciousness borrowed from the planet, really, because it's made out of the same elements as the planet, and the body is actually a micro planet. The body is a piece of land, and that kind of understanding can be cultivated through this particular meditation. And then the second one is recollection of death, which is recommended as a way of inspiring a sense of urgency for the practice and as a remedy against heedlessness. And also understanding, that the body is a riding animal for consciousness. And when the body has, come to the end of its life, it just, goes back into the planet from which it has emerged through a mother, which has been building us up in her own body by eating and drinking and, whatever has happened in there for a child to come through. So it shows us a different side of the embodied existence, which is very, very important, especially at this day and age, to understand that we are not separate from the planet and to we can't really get very far intellectually, but through these kind of meditations, it brings home that truth much more intimately. Recollection of death will be the next practice I'm going to teach when I see you next time in May. And then the other two, metta is the third one. We already did that one. And it's considered an antidote to anger and ill will and fear. Opens the heart, brings us back on track, when we have lost ourselves in different, emotions or so. And it really helps us to open the mind and the heart. And today we're going to speak about recollection of the Buddha, which is there to uplift, to bring faith and confidence in our own capacity, and to overcome fear. So these four recollections, four meditations, the first two are showing us, let's say I did a different order actually. Let's say the recollection on the Buddha and metta meditation shows us the potential of a human life, and the next to the meditation on the body and meditation on death shows us the limitations of a human life. So it shows us the realities, and on the one hand, elevate the mind and allow the mind to open to that which it doesn't know yet, to let come. And the other two show us the limitation and the attachments and supports letting go. So it's about letting go and letting come, letting go and letting come. And then, if we have this kit of four meditations, we can see, what's needed in our life right now, and then can, like a toolbox, we can say, okay, today it would be good if I meditate on death, for example. And maybe tomorrow it's going to be helpful to, do a metta meditation, depending on what's needed in order to bring the mind into balance. So they're not, called protective meditations because they're like a magic kind of talisman, but they are called protective meditations because they protect us from our own greed, hatred, and delusion, and from the greed, hatred, and delusion of others. So that's why they are protective. And it helps us, to transform obstacles into opportunities and reminds us what is really true and what is really possible. Helping us to let go of old patterns and helping us to stay open for that which is emerging, which we don't really know yet. So I think that's like the overview. And today we're going to go more a little into detail regarding the Buddhanusati, which is, Buddha, the word you already have heard many times, and Anusati means recollection. To use sati, mindfulness, to consider certain things, to consider certain features of our experience, for example, when we are doing insight meditation. And in this case, we are considering certain qualities of the Buddha and use them to uplift the mind. And they are relatively not at all taught in the West. The Western, meditation guidance is usually not concerned a lot with faith. And it's because it's relatively difficult to teach in the West, but I thought nevertheless I'd like to introduce it to you because it's one of those four protective meditations and it might work for some of you. In the West, it's a bit difficult, to work with devotion. People don't, that doesn't come so easy in Buddhist circles. I think in Christian circles, it doesn't seem to be an issue, but for us here, it is maybe slowly coming back, as we are understanding after 30 years of insight meditation or 40 years of insight meditation that we need some support to master the courage, to stay really open to what we see in the meditation. And for that, devotional practices can be really helpful. When the intellect can't really help us anymore, we need to activate something different. And that's devotion. And because the external image of the Buddha puts us in touch with our own true nature, and we just took the refuges before, and when we're taking refuge in Buddha, you were actually, strictly speaking, taking refuge in your own capacity for awakening. Because it's not just taking refuge in a historical man, you know, who lived in Iron Age India and has left us this very pragmatic teaching, but it's also, you know, to really awaken the Buddha inside of ourselves, which is awareness. And you're remembering that when the hindrances are going high, that's really what the essence of the practice is, to remember awareness and not become the greed, the hatred, the delusion, but rather being aware of it. And that's what the Buddha, the refuge into Buddha, symbolizes. And even if we bow, you know, bow to the Buddha statue, then actually we could say we bow to our own potential for awakening. And, you know, when we've heard probably the greeting, you know, Asian greeting, namaste, means, you know, I greet the divine in you. That's actually, you know, I greet that capacity for full awakening in you. So we recognize in ourselves the very Buddha in whom we take refuge. You know, that there is no external Buddha who is gonna, you know, rescue us. I mean, he's given us the teachings, but we have to do it ourselves. And in the process of doing it, we become more and more resilient that we can really trust our own capacity for awakening. So it throws us back on ourselves. And the Buddha statue is a symbol for that. And so, you know, and what the teacher, what is the most important service, you know, a teacher can render is to encourage and confirm and build up the confidence in the student that has confidence in his or her own capacity for awakening. That's to reflect that back, you know, and to remind about that. Yes, you know, I can do it too, because I'm a human being, just like the Buddha was not a god. The Buddha was just a human being like us. He just had, you know, have done the work really through many, many lifetimes. And if we do it as well, we also one day, you know, will be free from greed, hatred, and delusion and, you know, realize arahantship, how it's called in the Theravada teaching. Or if we want to go for Buddhahood, we can do that too. Takes longer. And so remembering, you know, the Buddha was a human being. Not to forget that. Don't fall into the trap that you elevate the Buddha so much, you know, that you just give up. That can just be like, you know, an excuse. You can use it for an excuse that you don't need to practice. And also, you know, not minimizing the accomplishment that he indeed has realized, you know, the ultimate. And finding the middle way, you know, between those two, that I can't do it, or it's not that special. Finding the middle way and maybe, you know, imagining, you know, what a tremendous influence the Buddha has had for the good on this planet. There's millions of people practicing Buddhism today, you know, and millions of people have practiced it over the centuries. This kind of teaching is around since Iron Age India, which is like 2,600 years ago. And it has been, you know, transmitted the first 600 years or so orally because there was no writing yet. And after that, it was written down for the first time in Sri Lanka and has been coming to us, you know, to over certain different lineages. And I myself, you know, have received this teaching from my first teacher, Ajahn Buddhadasa, who was a Thai forest tradition master, and then from Ajahn Sumedho and the Siladhara Sangha in Amaravati, who received the teaching from Ajahn Chah. And then later on, I also received teachings from my Tibetan teacher, Nyingma teacher, Shechen Rabchan Rinpoche, and Titlokien Seyangsi Rinpoche. So that's the transmission lines, you know, which come together in myself. And when I was young, I was growing up in Austria, you know, which is a Catholic country. And that's also part of the transmission, you know, I have in myself. And over the years, you know, in the beginning, it's all quite separate. And then over the years, you know, practicing now since the late 80s, you know, I had started to synthesize. And now I don't anymore, you know, have a need to separate all of that out. But it finds some kind of resolution in myself. And yeah, just imagining the inconceivable good influence the Buddha has had on so many people on this planet. And maybe, you know, imagining to have a mind like that, you know, as vast as the sky. And it's hard to imagine. But later on, you know, in the guided meditation, we're going to try to have a taste of that. You know, like the sky where there's all clouds have parted and there's just this vast expanse which is boundless. And you know, the recollection of the Buddha is actually based on a chant, which is part of the morning and evening chanting. It's a very short chant, and I'm going to chant it now just to give you a little intro. And it's called Itipiso, the chant. And Itipiso means so he is. And then it mentions these nine qualities. And then after that, after the chanting, I'm going to go over the nine qualities. And then we're going to do a guided meditation using just three. And using those three qualities like a mantra, you know, to settle the mind and the body. And then at one point we can just drop it and just continue with the meditation, whatever meditation object you use. So it's a good thing, you know, to use at the beginning of the meditation, maybe for 10 minutes or however long it takes you. And then you can just drop it and sit in the way you usually sit. So let me just start with the chant. Itipiso Bhagava Arahang Samma Sambuto Vicca Charana Sampano Sukato Lokavitu Anuttaro Purisatamma Saratisata Deva Manusanang Bhuto Bhagavati. So that's the chant. Carolyn, did you know that chant? Because you chanted a little. Okay, you know, you had a little bit, uh-huh. Okay, nice. All right. Okay, so that was that chant. And I'm just going to go over those qualities to give you like a taste of them. And these nine qualities, you know, they are five internal qualities of the Buddha and four external qualities. So five internal qualities which make him a really reliable teacher. And then four external qualities which make him in somebody, you know, who really can relate to people and can meet them where they are. So that makes him just a very skillful teacher, because he knows how to meet people and give them just the right nudge, you know, so that they can maybe open up into something which they couldn't have done without that nudge. And so those qualities, you know, they are used as springboards for the mind in the meditation, which we will do afterwards. So let me just go over it. So the first one, arahang, that's how I started. Arahang or arahant means completely eliminated all greed, hatred, and delusion from the mind to never arise again. So it's a permanent permanent removal of them, because we can experience in the meditation, and we will do that afterwards, we can experience a temporary removal of greed, hatred, and delusion. You know, when the mind is really in samadhi, when the mind is still and stable, the hindrances go into abeyance. So temporarily they are not active, and then we have a taste of this boundless sky mind. But then, you know, when we come out of the meditation and somebody steps on our toe, bing, it comes all back again. So it was just dormant temporarily, but nevertheless, it gives us a taste. And my first teacher, Ajahn Buddhadasa, called that a little nibbana, you know. Like when you, before you buy something, a big box of cookies, you might just want to taste one. And then, you know, I like that. Okay, I'm gonna get that. So that's that. The first one. So fully purified and liberated from samsara, and you know, have to come back. Has no need. So it's a complete purity. And the next word, sambuddho, means perfectly enlightened, fully awakened without a teacher. Because the Buddha has had some teachers, but then the breakthrough, you know, to his realization, he found by himself. I think, you know, it's the laws of nature working, but he had the perseverance to stick it out, you know, not giving up. So that means, you know, sambuddho, he's fully awakened and he fully understands all the dharmas and is able to teach them. So that's the next one. We can also call it complete wisdom. So the first one was complete purity, second one is complete wisdom. And then the next word is vicca charana sampanno, which means perfect knowledge and understanding and perfect conduct and virtue. So he has perfected knowledge as well as conduct. So he walks his talk perfectly. There's no discrepancy between what he says and what he does. Next one, sugato, means well gone. Somebody who has fully gone along the Noble Eightfold Path and reached the goal, nirvana or nibbana. And then the last one of the internal qualities is lokavidu, which means knower of the worlds. He has fully understood, you know, all of the worlds with all its different realms. Like the, you know, speaking from the human realm and the animal kingdom and the hungry ghosts and the heavenly realms and the hell realms. If that makes sense to you, if not, just drop it. And then also the realms, the inner realms of existence, which is called the five aggregates, the five khandhas, the six sense bases. So understood all dimensions, you know, which we can access with these minds of ours. So that's the five internal qualities which makes the Buddha a reliable teacher. And then the four external qualities. Next one is Anuttaro Purisa Dhammasarathi, which means unsurpassed teacher and trainer of people who want to be trained. So he understands their capacity, disposition, attitudes, and he knows exactly, you know, where to kind of guide them. That was very special about the Buddha, that he was so tuned in, you know, attuned. And he would exactly know what to say or not say, you know, to a very intellectual, very highly educated person, or to a very simple farmer. Next one is Satta Deva Manusanang, which means teacher of beings in the heavenly realms, the devas, and Manusa, human beings. So he could teach in both realms, and the devas would come to listen to his teachings. It's said in the scriptures. And then the next one is butoh, which means a vacant one. Well, also can mean awakener of others. He's an awakened one, but he's also an awakener of others. And then the next word is Bhagava, which means holy one or blessed one, exalted one. And this word is still used today in India, for holy people, for saints. Bhagavan. And in the scriptures, that word is used much, much more than the word Buddha. So the Buddha is referred to as Bhagava in the scriptures. And what that means, the Blessed One means he has fulfilled all of the qualities we were just going through out of his great compassion, for beings. He felt like he can find the way and he wanted to teach others. So that was at the root of his practice, was that compassion to help others. And so that word is used in the canon much more than the word Buddha. But then, when it came over to the West, it just was considered is a better way of working with that whole teaching by calling it a different way, and that was probably right, And then after 30, 40, 50 years of trying to cut everything out, and just leave the wisdom core, we have run out of steam, and now we are slowly getting interested in devotional practices and in other ways, to uplift the heart and the mind so that we can keep on practicing. Okay, so I think that's it, that's those nine qualities. And before I start with the guided meditation, just wondering if anyone has a question, because it's a bit much, what I was, but you don't need to know all of that stuff anyway. I just wanted to give you an opportunity. But now we're just going to use three qualities, very simple, and that's going to be easy. But please ask if there's anything before we get started. You can just unmute yourself. Okay, no questions. Okay, let's try. So if you want to maybe, have 2, 3 minutes to stretch your legs, please do so. And then we're going to sit 35 minutes. Stretch yourself. Maybe get a drink or go to the bathroom. Let's all come back at 6:50. And Mary Kelly? Oh, I thought you wanted something now. All right. See you in at 6:50. So I'm gonna ring the bell. People come back. So, I hope you're back. If you can turn on your cameras, that we can slowly, that we can see if you're back or not. Okay, so you know, let's find a posture we can sustain for about 35 minutes or so. And sensing your body and allowing the breath to take you into the body. And then, if you can. You can follow now my guidance, and we're gonna use like one word at a time. Arahang is the first one, means complete purity. I'm gonna say it in Pali and in English, and then while, and you can also then use that, say the same word, use it like a mantra, give the mind something to do. And at the same time, you can also visualize, the face of the Buddha, Arahang, complete purity. Maybe a face of the Buddha, emerges. I'm just holding that as long as it's there. And then the next word is Samma Sambuddho, complete wisdom. And then, looking in the eyes of the Buddha. And you don't no need to force anything, it might just come as we are going through this now for 10 minutes or so. And then the last one is Bhagava, complete compassion. And then looking at his feet, he was walking through India for 45 years to teach after his awakening, until he was over 80 years old when he passed away. So, and then starting again, Arahang. Complete purity. Just visualizing the face of the Buddha. Samma Sambuddho, complete wisdom, and looking into the eyes of the Buddha. Bhagava, complete compassion. Looking at his feet, which carried him all over India for 45 years to teach. Arahang, complete purity. Looking at the face. Samma Sambuddho, complete wisdom. Looking into his eyes. Bhagava, complete compassion. Looking at those feet. Arahang, complete purity. Samma Sambuddho. Complete wisdom. Bhagava, complete compassion. Arahang, complete purity. some Buddha complete wisdom. Bhagava, complete compassion. Arahang, complete purity. Sammasambuddho, complete wisdom. Bhagava, complete compassion. Arahang, complete purity. Sammasambuddho, complete wisdom. Bhagava, complete compassion. Just, looking at the mind, and probably the mind is just empty of any thought. Just noticing that. That's a taste of Nibbana. The wide open, boundless mind, which effortlessly reflects back whatever is happening. There's a sound, you can hear my voice, we don't need to do anything about that. It's just what the mind does. And then, really noticing the spaciousness, the boundlessness, the purity of that mind when all of the hindrances are temporarily in abeyance. That is a little taste of the summum bonum of the practice. And then, in case the mind starts throwing up thoughts again, then you can just come back to the mantra, Arahang, complete wisdom, complete purity, sorry. Sammasambuddho, complete wisdom. Bhagava, complete compassion. And when the mind is settled, and when there's stability, focus, samadhi, then we can just drop the mantra, drop any object, and just maybe take spaciousness as the object. Knowing spaciousness, boundless spaciousness. Really listening into that spaciousness, which doesn't end at the walls of the room you're sitting in. And the silence, and with the out-breath relaxing into that expansiveness. So the silence and the expansion, the boundlessness of the mind can be used as a more subtle object. The mantra was pretty, a lot to do, to say the mantra in the mind and to visualize the face, the eyes and the feet. And then, once the mind has been settling, like chasing a little dog around, and then at one point it gets tired and it lays down. That's what we want. So we give the mind the mantra and the visualization to, transform into more peaceful energy by using the energy in this very skillful way, and then holding just the spaciousness and the silence as an object. So, because the mind needs a little something to do. Otherwise, it gets active again. And then at the same time, if you're noticing the spaciousness, the silence, then you might hear sounds arising. Noticing the impermanence. And just allowing whatever arises on that mirror of the mind, just let it move through. No need to hold onto it, no need to push it away, just giving space. So that it can do its thing. No need to nail anything down. No need to defend against anything. And maybe noticing, the subtle joy or contentment which comes with a wide open mind, which isn't holding on to anything. Listening to the silence, the boundlessness of the mind. Or maybe even, you can notice the vibrancy of that boundlessness. Full of potential. It's not an emptiness, which is a lack of anything, but it's a fullness. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. So, and if your mind, gets busy again, you could just come back to the mantra, if that's helpful, or noticing the boundless space, the silence. And the vibrancy of the aliveness which permeates all of this. The body, the spaciousness, the planet on which we are sitting, it's all alive. They're all different, vibrational presentation of that aliveness. and we are part of that. And that's a realization which is now becoming more and more important, you know, for us to really intimately relate to. You know, as there is lots of you know, unprecedented difficulties becoming conscious, you know, in terms of what it means, you know, for so many people to live together on a planet like this. We need to take an interest in this. And then, you know, we can maybe, you know, drop the spaciousness and the silence as an object and becoming aware of that which knows about the spaciousness and the silence. It's like almost they're making a U-turn, awareness becoming aware of itself. Not as an object, because that's not really possible, but by being awareness. Being that aliveness, not taking that as an object, but directly being that, where object and subject become one. And then there's just being aware. And that's the refuge in Buddha. That's that in a practice which starts to first project it out onto somebody else, like on a historical Buddha who lived in Iron Age India, and then through following the practices, we are more and more realizing that that very Buddha is our own capacity for awakening. It's not someone else. But we need, you know, we need teachers and spiritual friends to help us you know, to realize that, to integrate that. And you know, for the remainder of the meditation, I'll leave you to yourself now, and then I'll ring the bell in about 15 minutes or so. Then we have a little bit time for the metta dedications. So now we're slowly coming to the end of the meditation. So coming, into the body. And noticing, the quality of the mind now after this meditation. And when you are, when you hear the bell and opening your eyes, just, trying to stay connected with your body from inside as you're opening your eyes and looking around in the Zoom room with whom you are here. And after that, Vida will then read out the metta dedications of merit.